We're going to talk about what are the possibilities to educate for faith in today's Ireland. I was just saying to Justin on the way down here, in some ways it's easy enough to do religious education, especially if you take it as something that you teach the same way as you teach math or history or social studies or whatever. There's no great mystery, really, to teaching it just as a discipline of learning. And unfortunately, I would say that's a golden opportunity missed. There could be a possibility to do it in ways that nurture people's faith. And if only their faith in themselves, or their faith in other people, or their faith in life, maybe even a faith in God, maybe even faith in Jesus Christ. But I still think it's possible to do that. Very challenging. But on the other hand, too, a kind of a unique time and opportunity. And basically what I'd like to do, I think we'll have about three mini sessions of about 45 minutes each, and I'll engage you, of course, along the way. I'm going to kind of lay out, good morning, come on in, three kind of moments or foci of conversation. The first one, we're going to talk a little bit about the challenge it is, but also the opportunity it is to educate for faith in contemporary Ireland. And I want to kind of situate that conversation a little bit. We could spend all day talking about it, we won't, but we get a flavor at least for the context, the historical, cultural context and time and place in which we find ourselves, because you know more keenly, a thousand times better than I, it's enormously challenging. And it's a new day and a different day and a whole, the playing field, the goalposts have moved, and indeed it's a whole new playing field. So it's not what it was at all, but what is it? And if we've some sense of that of what the reality that faces us and the challenges of it, but also I will be proposing the opportunities it offers as well, because I think there's ways to educate for a chosen faith, for a convicted faith, for a personally embraced faith, the like of which we haven't had before. Because in many ways it came with the culture, it came with our mother's milk, it was inherited, and that was fine. But in a sense, when the inheritance has been set aside, it can give the option of a more chosen, a more deliberately embraced, and a more convicted, a more persuaded faith, perhaps. And of course, Aquinas, at least, was convinced that if you're more persuaded of it, you're also a little more likely to live it. So we'll do a little bit on that at the beginning, and then I'm going to pose the question, and again, it'll be clarifying, maybe, maybe not, and you may say to Justin, why did you bring that fellow here? What faith are we teaching? And I think, can there be faith? Will there be faith? He asked the question himself, it's the title of a good book, but nonetheless, will there be faith? Because it was a fascinating moment, actually. In Luke's Gospel 18, he was been rambling around the roads of Galilee for 3 years, and it was as if he was heading into Jerusalem, because chapter 18 of Luke is the end of his public ministry. Chapter 19 is when he enters into Holy Week in Jerusalem. He says, when they come again, will there be faith? Will there be faith on earth? And I think it's a question now with an urgency and an emergency that we've never had before. Will there be faith? And it was almost a profound human moment when he said to himself, will any of this last? Will it last? Will it continue? And I don't think we can just take it for granted. And you know this better than I. So we're going to ask the question, not only will there be faith, but what faith? What's the core? What's the faith that might engage, that might persuade, that might be powerfully life-giving liberating? For our time, because I do think that the faith can have that extraordinary potential. But in a sense, how we tell the story and what story we tell has a great deal of import for whether or not anybody will take it and make it their own and let it become their own story and embrace it and put it to work in their lives. I think how we tell the story and what story we tell, there's a lot riding on that. That'll be our second moment of the morning. And then the third moment will be, is there a way to go about it? What's the pedagogy? Because I do think an awful lot depends on the pedagogy we use. And I think there's pedagogies we can use. I think we can have people in religion or theology or catechetical or whatever you want to call them, classes, religious education classes for 12, 13 years. And we can teach in a way that doesn't touch their lives at all. And that at the end of the day, they may get honors in their leaving cert, in what do you call it, theology or what's it called, religious education, they may get top grades, but be totally untouched by it at a personal level. And whether we do that or do something that invites them to take it and make it their own and live out of it, or at least to learn from it, to be enriched by it, I think whether or not we get that job done, a great deal depends on the pedagogy that we use. And I do see you people as enormously strategically located in the church here in Ireland as diocesan advisors. And I see you as amazingly located as by way of influencing that. And I must say, I remember the diocesan examiners, you used to be called, coming to the Clonmacnoise National School, and we'd be all lined up, and the teacher being terrified that we would miss the catechism questions or answers. And I remember the diocesan advisor coming along and say, who made the world? God made the world. Who is God? God, why did God make you? God made. That was a great question, by the way, to know, love, and serve. We'll come back to that later. So that's basically what we're going to do. We take little breaks along the way. What do you think? Is that a good way to spend the morning? You do? Okay. Well, that's the only thing I've prepared, so it's what we're going to do anyway. But it's nice to know that you think that. Can we educate? Okay, so let's, how about the Old Irish scene, the historical and the contextual challenges? I want to begin at the beginning. The Great Commission by the risen Christ on a hillside in Galilee. 2,000 years ago, he assembled a little community on this hillside, a little remnant, and he gave them this great commission. Now, the way he put it to them, he says, go make disciples of all nations. And by the way, if you're taking notes, take your own notes. Don't take my notes, because I'll give you my notes at the end, if you stay till the end. I'll give you my notes. So if you're taking notes, don't feel you have to write down what you see up here. But do note what you're thinking, or what your neighbor says to you in a few minutes. Go make disciples of all nations, baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teach them into the inner life of God. Baptize them into taking the community and into the inner life of the triune God. And then says, and teach them to observe everything I've commanded you. Now, a great debate broke out in the early church as to whether or not they should the church evangelize, should they simply go make disciples, or should they also teach? Wouldn't it be enough to simply teach them to evangelize, teach them the gospel? But why would they ever get involved in education? And it was a great debate. I won't bore you with the details, but all kinds of characters gotten involved. Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian was totally opposed, for example, to the church getting involved in education. It was enough for the church to teach the gospel. That's all it had to do. But teaching reading, writing, arithmetic, rhetoric, the common subjects, as it were, that the church was not to be involved in that. And the church basically decided that it should do both, to evangelize and to educate. And in the words of Clement of Alexandria, because it says both were a work of salvation. And it was from that, and it's also the debate, and I won't bore you with it, and it would take this too far afield, but basically what they came to recognize was that the gospel values could be a powerful source of education. Not just in faith, but in reading, writing, arithmetic, and how to make meaning out of life, the values that you'd live by, that it could be a powerful foundation for an educational system. It could provide not just a philosophy of education, but a kind of a spirituality of education. And it came out of their conversation with Greek philosophers, where they began to see tremendous simpatico between reason and revelation, between faith and reason, between learning and values, between gospel and culture, that they could come together as a great paideia, was the word they use, as a great kind of a rich combination that would enhance people's lives in the world, not just teach them a faith, but would enhance everything, that would enhance the quality of life in the world and so on. So it was a great debate. As I said, we could go far afield upon it. But since then, in many ways, the Catholic Church did become and has become the largest and the most influential educator in the world. That sounds like a pretentious claim, but when you stand back and you think about it, all over the ages and all the countries, if you put the Catholic school system of North America, Canada, South America, Africa, China, Asia, Australia, Ireland, if you put them all together, it has been the most influential educator in the world. And I think can still do a powerful life-giving education. The monastic schools, those early catechetical schools in Alexandria and Rome and Antioch that they put together, led on into the monastic schools, to the great cathedral schools. We were just talking about the great monastic school at Clonard, where we come from. Before, your first name again is
Hannah.
Sorry, Hannah. I met everybody at once, so I asked the names again. But we're just talking about the great schools, the great Celtic schools at Durrow and Clonard and all the rest of it, on into Iona, and led on then into the founding of the first great universities. Salamanca and Bologna, and then Paris, Oxford, Cambridge, were all founded ex corde ecclesiae, as a document of about 10 years ago said, from the heart of the church. And they were commissioned, all the great universities were founded by papal charter, were staffed by the emerging religious orders, the Augustinians, the Franciscans, Dominicans then, later then, Mercies and Presentations and all kinds of communities, became the whole backbone in many ways of the intellectual life, at least of the Western world. But always with the conviction to educate from a faith perspective as well as for a faith perspective. And that 2,000-year legacy lives on. And you see, the characteristic of it was that it was to be centered in God and the person, in faith and reason, in knowledge and spiritual wisdom, in learning and gospel values. Because you see, what happened with the Enlightenment in the Western world is the Enlightenment, well, beginning with the Reformation, then leading on into the Enlightenment, basically took God out of the school, out of the education, took faith out of education, took spiritual wisdom out of education, took gospel values out. And then you're left with an educational system that attends to the person and critical reason and teaches knowledge and learning and what have you. But it's not as capable, or it can be a powerful educational system, but it's not nearly as likely to lend the person a transcendent perspective on life and meaning and purpose, a sense of why. The great questions of life, why is there anything rather than nothing, and so on, that purely secular education is not capable of raising those issues or responding to those questions. Whereas an educational system grounded in Christian faith has that potential. So in a sense, it has an enormous potential by way of being humanizing, by way of helping people to make and keep life human for themselves and for the life of the world. It has a potential that if you take God out of it and faith out of it and spiritual wisdom and values out of it, it's very difficult to be, I think, as humanizing. And now, and that's what happened. This is Oxford or someplace. But that's what happened when the great universities, in a sense, they took out the God bit and the faith bit and the revelation bit, and then there was nothing but a kind of a, what they call a secular education. And it's, of course, it can be a powerful way of learning and a powerful means of knowledge and so on, but there's something tremendously of value in a faith-based education. I'm singing for the choir, but I suppose that's the context within which you work then as diocesan advisors in your schools. And I know it's debated, and I know there's a lively debate here in Ireland. There's people who would like to take the faith-based perspective out of it altogether, but it would be an impoverished, I think, a deeply impoverished school system, which doesn't mean at all that our schools are to proselytize and all this, or manipulate people into faith, not at all. There's no need for that, and I'll come back to that later when we talk about the pedagogy. But it's interesting. I was in a Catholic school in Chicago not so long ago that's 89% non-Catholic in its student body, and whose parents send their children there precisely because they can get some values formation, they can get some faith perspective on life, they can get a God outlook on the world and on themselves and other brothers and sisters. And they do it precisely because of the value they see in that faith-based education. Coming to the Irish context, you know this better than I'll be very brief about it. We basically grew up in an enchanted world, as Weber would call it. You know, I was out walking with my sister yesterday evening, and we were both saying, you know, we both still believe in ghosts. She lives alone. And she says, how do you feel living alone? She says, I'm often kind of scared at night. I hear noises. But she says, I was always kind of afraid of the dark. I said, God, that's funny. Now, I'm still kind of afraid of the dark myself. In a sense, we all grew up in a world, an enchanted world, where there were angels and devils and ghosts and werewolves and banshees. And we had a sense of the spiritual, of the ultimate, of the transcendent in the midst of it all. Now we're into a disenchanted world. In a secular age, as Taylor talks about. And there's at least three different forms of secularization, as Taylor talks about, or de-traditionalization, or whatever you want to call it. Let me not I'd bore you with all three of them, but the separation of church and state is basically one meaning, the secularization. That's a good arrangement. The drop-off of religious practice, and people like Davy talking about many people have faith without belonging. And I think that's an important point. Lots of people who don't go to church are still people of deep faith. Like the statistics, I was reading some of them coming along on the plane, that almost 70% of Irish people still say that they pray daily. Almost 50% go to Mass regularly, maybe not every Sunday, but once a month at least. They're very high figures. And then there's lots of people who say that they're spiritual but not religious, which often means they have a deep faith in God, but meanwhile they may not come and assemble with the community regularly. But there is a deep drop-off, and I think the church has to face that and ask, why do we drive people away? The last census in the United States, the last Pew report, had 35 million people in the U.S. who claimed to be former Catholics. 35 million people. The largest religion in America is Catholicism. The second largest religion in America is former Catholicism. People who say that they used to be Catholic. But you have to say to yourself, now what is our church doing that is so effective in driving people away? Like, there's something we're doing to drive people away rather than to bring them along. And I think this is what Pope Francis is trying to bring us back to, that there are ways to bring people along rather than to drive them away. And who the heck is entitled to send anybody away as if we are living it faithfully? Like, which one of us goes the extra mile, turns the other cheek, loves the enemy, prays for those who hate us? None of us live this gospel to its perfection, nor is it hardly possible. It's like an impossible ideal to live it perfect. And of course, all the great saints always lamented how far short they were falling. But so who's entitled to send others away? I think that's what Francis is trying to say to us. Bring people along, because they deserve and they're entitled to come along. But anyway, so it is a serious issue. But the most difficult or challenging aspect of all, Taylor says, is that the conditions of belief have changed, because we've come from an enchanted world that kind of disposed us toward faith to a world that marginalizes faith or offers alternatives to faith. And he says the most favorite alternative is what he calls an exclusive humanism. And he calls it exclusive in the sense that it excludes any reference to the transcendent. It's a deep form of humanism, but nonetheless, there's no appeal to a transcendent realm or to a transcendent ground or warrant for it all. And that's the most difficult, that's the most challenging aspect of secularization. Let me give you a personal example. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, living up in Clonard, I developed pneumonia. It was a winter's night. My dad was in Dublin, in the Dáil. My mother was home alone. I'm the youngest of 9 kids. They'd already lost a little daughter, a little girl, a few years prior to pneumonia. So on a winter's night on an Irish farm up around Clonard 60 years ago, pneumonia was a major emergency. She couldn't drive, even if she had a car. To yoke up a horse and pony, or a pony and trap, and to take the kid out in the winter's night would have probably killed him. So what did she do? Well, she knelt down beside my bed, and how she told the story, and she told the story 1,000 times after, especially when I got into trouble. Only for my prayers, you wouldn't even be here, you know. But she knelt down beside my bed, and she told God that she wasn't going to leave there until my fever broke. And she fell asleep, I fell asleep, we both woke up, and my fever had broken. Now she went to her grave swearing that was a miracle. I've never decided one way or the other. The point I want to make is, her grandchildren would never do what she did. Do you know what they'd do instead? They'd pop the kid in the SUV, and they'd be in the village in 10 minutes, the child would get a course of penicillin and would be running around in a couple of days. And it's not that her grandchildren aren't people of faith and great and decent people, they are. But they had the car and they take the kid to the doctor. So in other words, we don't need God the way we used to. Or as so we could think. And it's not how, so that the secularization, we often think of it as a bad thing or a negative thing. But some of it is very positive. Some of it is out of medical progress, scientific progress. That a lot of the reasons why the old world needed God are gone. And then not only did she do what she did, but she also told the story. So it became part of her family catechesis. Then she repeated over and over again. Now we wouldn't have stories like that to tell. So that, and you can think of thousands of examples in your own life how in a sense faith gets marginalized in this post-secular, modernized, postmodern, all kinds of fancy names for it. So that it's not all, what I want to emphasize is it's not all bad. In the church, then you've got the dreadful scandals that betray the gospel and the Catholic faith, the divisions, the revisions, the tensions, especially around Vatican II, even around Pope Francis. I mean, God, this morning's paper is full of it again from this terrible, terrible situation in Tuam. As well as that, the millennials question the whole rationale for beliefs. At least this is what we're told, that the whole business of being convinced by reason alone of beliefs is something that there's a deep skepticism to that in this whole postmodern era. A skepticism about institutional authorities, about meta-narratives, about reason alone. So it's a kind of a time of deep skepticism. Now, I think there can be blessings in our contemporary consciousness. We've learned a great deal. And in many ways, a contemporary consciousness has sent us back to our original documents. And we have found recessive genes there that in fact are tremendously life-giving. So in a sense, it's contemporary consciousness. The feminist movement, for example, has made us somewhat conscious of how deeply sexist we can be. And chauvinist and misogynist in our faith and in how we present it and how we represent ourselves as a faith community. It has made us aware of our racism, of our homophobia in deep ways, of unregulated capitalism. So in a sense, and what has happened is that it has sent us back to reread our texts and to see that indeed they should be emancipatory and liberating and inclusive and respectful of all people, and that anything less is a form of heresy to our religion. So it sent us back to the recessive genes to find the warrants for human rights and social justice and care for the environment. And it isn't that it is, and you see a lot of it is simply out of our contemporary situation. Why is the church only talking about the environment now? Why wasn't it talking about it the year 1500? Because it didn't need to. We weren't able to destroy it. In the year 1500. So the toxins and the pollutants that we put into our soil and our air and our water and all of the global warming, we didn't do that before. But so in a sense, some of it gets discovered and uncovered as we go along. I always love the text that's in Matthew 13, verse 51, where he says, "The scribe learned in the reign of God has to be like the head of a household who takes from the treasury both the old and the new." So we have to take the old truths with us, but also there's new truths and new awarenesses and new consciousness and new perspectives that we have to be ready to embrace. God's Spirit is still working in the world, etc., etc. So let me push on and get you with this. The disenchantment, there's also the disenchantment is confronted by the thin moments. I'm coming now to the more positive things, because while there's a disenchantment, yet there's thin moments of God's presence and occasions and happenings that come and go. I'll tell another quick story. I have a friend, Joe, who was a student. We were colleagues together 40 years ago in a doctoral program at Columbia University in New York. And Joe decided then, we drank a lot of big pitchers of beer deciding this. But Joe decided at that time he was an atheist. And I spent a lot of time trying to convince Joe not to be an atheist. As I said, we drank a lot of beer in honor of that, a good cause. But basically, I failed. But we've remained friends over the years. So I was in New York recently, and Joe said he'd like to have lunch. So I went to have lunch with Joe, and he wanted to tell me a story. He said, "You know, now Joe, I should preface this, I don't want to take too long, has been unlucky in love. and has been through at least a couple of marriages and a couple of very broken, long-term broken relationships. And I'd say a lot of it could be Joe's own problem, but nevertheless. So he meets me, he's 65 now, and he began to tell me this extraordinary story about this amazing woman, that he's fallen madly in love with this marvelous woman. And the better still, she has fallen madly in love with him. And he goes on and on and on and finally stopped. So he said to me, I'm kind of scared of the whole thing. He said, I don't want to get involved and get hurt all over. He said, God, I've had such bad luck. He says, I just don't want to go there. And yet, she's a marvelous woman, blah, blah, blah. And he paused. He said, what do you think? I said, Joe, I think it's a gift from God. And he said, oh, no, Tom, now look, we went through that 40 years ago, this God stuff. Now, don't start that crap with me, this God thing, this gift, Lord, this. I said, okay, sorry, Joe, okay. Yeah, no, I'm sure it's chemistry. I'm sure it's just chemistry. And I waited. And I looked up after a while and Joe had tears in his eyes. And he said, no, it's not just chemistry. And I knew that Joe was having his doubts about his atheism. And God will always be up to something. We have to remember this. And that God's grace will always be at work. Even in difficult, complex, contrary times, even in disenchanted worlds, that they're thin. The thin moments, that old tradition in Celtic spirituality, there are thin moments, thin places, thin people where the veil is lifted, if not, or at least becomes gossamer thin. And the whole subtraction theory that was so popular, we're talking to Justin coming along about this, that there's a whole assumption in modernity that faith would simply pass away with reason. That because it was, as soon as you became enlightened, you'd stop believing, because that was just simply the pishrogues of your grandparents, you know, the superstition. But that has proved totally false. And the whole attitude that, you know, to not believe is kind of a sophisticated, enlightened position, whereas believing is an old just tradition or superstition. We now recognize that both are Taylor calls takes. They're just simply outlooks. They're both perspectives, both equally biased, both equally prejudiced. It's not as if a non-fake perspective is enlightened, whereas a fake perspective is somewhat still muddied or simply held bound by the past or something. But both are deeply challenged. And this is where I say it could be an opportunity. It could be an opportunity. I want to bring you into the conversation for a chosen faith. And I'm going to come back to this. But if it is, I'm going to be emphasizing the importance of the heart's desires. Yeats's beautiful piece, The Land of Heart's Desire. Augustine said that there was the primary way to entice, to engage people. And I didn't mention it passing, but if you go back up in my overheads, that the kind of skepticism about reason alone is very deep. But even as there's a skepticism about, and all of the research, at least in the United States, indicates that people who leave the church stop believing. They stop believing the teachings. But believing the teachings is kind of an intellectual. And that's, I mean, getting people to believe is terribly important. But there's also a whole relational, trust, affective, heartfelt aspect to faith that I think as religious educators we often underrate and don't engage. And in some ways I can understand why, but I think there are ways to engage people's heart's desires, the longings of what they really want out of life, the kind of person they'd love to be, the kind of life they'd love to live. Rather than just telling them a lot of dogmas and doctrines and the rationale for them, I think Jesus's whole pedagogy, in large part, was to appeal to people's heart's desires. Now he appealed to their mind. He appealed to logos and eros, to reason and desire. But the appeal to desire can be, I think, a powerful strategy by way of enticement, by way of persuasion. Yeats had a great verse, I think it was the last verse of his poem For All Old Age. God save me from those thoughts men think in the mind alone. They that sing a lasting song think in the marrow bone. So that mind alone approach to faith, I don't think will get us very far. It's important, it's included, it's needed, but the mind alone approach to faith, I think, will no longer succeed. Now, it did at a time and place, but I think getting into the marrow bone, into the deep heart's core, as he might call it, of people's lives, into the desires. We'll come back to that many times in the pedagogy. Let me skip these because they're only boring and bring you in immediately into the conversation. What do you see? Take a moment. Sorry, I should have been here sooner, but you'll get to it now. What do you see as major challenges to educating for Christian faith in Ireland today? And don't be afraid to state the obvious. My mentor in life, Paulo Freire, always said to people, always write down the obvious. It's probably what you should know, but you don't know it until you write it down because it's so obvious. So whatever it is that occurs to you as the challenges, the primary challenges to educating for faith, how would you name them? Take a note from yourself. And as I said, don't be afraid to write down the obvious. A second question, what do you see as some of the deep hopes, and particularly Irish, this old culture that has had this faith for, 1,500 years? There's deep stuff. Carl Jung says that the archetypes of a culture last 400 or 500 years, even after you've decided to get rid of them, that they live on. So there's deep down structures of faith that are riven into Irish consciousness. What Foucault talks about, the archaeology, if you dig down deep into this tradition, there's layers and layers and layers of practices and traditions that in fact are deeply Christian, that arose out of the faith tradition. And without this faith tradition, we wouldn't have. If we'd grown up in a Buddhist or a Confucian or a Hindu world, we'd have other convictions, other rich convictions, but we wouldn't have the ones we have. So in a sense, this faith has shaped who we are as a people deeply. And there could be old embers. I don't remember the Gaelic, but I remember an old shanachal that quenched coals are easily lit. In other words, it's easy enough to get the fire started from the coals left over. So the embers, are there embers in this culture that could be fanned to great faith and it could be fanned to flame? Think about that. The Irish sources of hope, the embers that might be. Let me invite you into twos. We'll do this for about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and have general conversation. So here's a two trucker of people here, and here's a two, and here's a two, and here's a two, and here's a two, and there's a two, and here's a two, and here's a two, and here's a two. Talk to Father Michael here. Have a chat. If you don't feel like talking to your neighbor, don't bother. Just be willing to listen. The neighbor always has something to say. It invariably does. So have a chat with the neighbor. What are the embers? What are the hopes? What are the possibilities that you see? And feel free to respond to what I've been saying already, especially if you disagree or whatever. We'll have opportunity for that. But go to work for 3 to 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and see what wisdom we had among us. Well, when you're ready. We'll take a little break in about 10 minutes, but feel free if you need a break, go ahead and take a break, whatever. How about some of the signs of hopes? I found lots of wonderful signs of hopes here talking to my Father Michael. Things that occur to you that give a bit of hope? Somebody tell us a story.
It's actually delightful to walk into a school because we visit schools. It's lovely to walk into a school where there's a living sense of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
You can sense it. You can sense that it's prevalent in the way people engage with one another, in the graciousness, and they still have every other challenge.
Yeah.
But that's prevalent.
Yes.
And in some way it's nurtured.
Yes.
Yeah,
it can be there. Yeah. Marvelous.
I go into a primary as well, and that is the most uplifting experience, meeting a 7- and an 8-year-old, making their first Holy Communion.
Yes.
And see the light in their eyes when you talk about Jesus.
Yeah.
And yet I can meet the parents that night, and the light is dimmed. And yet the children are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
How they interpret who God is in Jesus.
I know it.
And they really believe it. And that's a great sense of hope.
Marvelous. And to tell them in a very real way that they are going to be meeting Jesus, receiving Jesus, it's one of the richest aspects of the tradition. Miss Garrity, I did it in second grade. I still make the Thanksgiving after receiving, the way she taught us. And this is 60 more years later. But it was a wonderful, wonderful gift, this sense that you were encountering the real presence of the risen Christ, of Jesus, and you could talk to him. You could talk to him yourself. I mean, to give them that depth. We're talking about sowing the seed. You know, I always think of evangelizing as sowing the seed, then catechizing as growing the seed. But unless you evangelize, unless you sow the seed, if there's no seed there, nothing will grow. But it can be that kind of moment they can sow the seed. Yeah, it's powerful. Another sign of hope.
We talked about the expression of being at the time of death.
A death. Yeah.
Yeah. Huge expression.
Yeah.
Of sympathy and wanting to engage in liturgy at that time.
Yes. And responding as a faith response. And that's terribly deep. Don't take that for granted. That is not everywhere. There's nothing like that in the States. Nothing comparable to awake. Now, I know it's receding, and in country areas is more prevalent still than in urban areas, blah, blah, blah. But it's a faith response to death and an affirmation that life is only changed. It's not ended. It's changed, as the preface of the resurrection says. And that they're gone home to God, and that they'll be all right, and they're in a better place now. And sure, they're with granny and grandfather. And it's a deep faith. And at least in my village, even the hard shaws show up for funerals. You know, the fellows that never come, and one knee in the back of the church, but they'll be at the funerals. And they're celebrations of faith.
And in schools, one of the first things that happen when there is a tragic death or a sudden death could be wanting to go to the oratory, not or in some way express, say a prayer or something.
Yeah. No, that's very deep.
And around anniversary masses, you find young people going to an anniversary mass for their grandmother or grandfather.
Yeah.
They wouldn't normally go to church
at all,
but they will go at
it. Yeah. Or the month's mine. That's a tradition only in this country. I don't know of it in any other country, the month's mine. We don't have it in the States. But it can be a great one, a family get together and so on. Other signs of hope, embers that could be lit.
I just think the goodness in young people's hearts. Things to do with justice and peace.
Yes.
They want to do something about it. And I think it's just a matter of making the little link between where these values come from.
Exactly.
They're God-given values.
Yes.
And it's a very small thing, but the hope is there.
Oh, God, it's a huge thing. It's marvelous. And tell them their stories, why we're committed to the poor and the down. This is not just philanthropy. This is not just philosophical, positive thinking or something. This is a mandate of our faith. God, our God, is a God of justice. Is a God who intervened in human history to set free and oppressed people and led them out of Egypt, and then sent God's own Son among us as one of ourselves to free us, to liberate us, to give us the commitment to justice. People often say to me, well, our young people are very committed to justice, but they don't go to church. I say, well, what a great start. I mean, even today's gospel reading, today's first reading, that if they're committed to the works of justice and compassion, they're a long way toward faith. They're a long way toward holiness of life. Even if they don't become card-carrying party members of our church, that to give them that basis and that commitment for life, they'll grow up to be holy people. Now, you can also say to them, and if you want to maintain your commitment to justice and to compassion, you'll need spiritual resources. You can't maintain it lifelong, or it's very difficult to maintain it lifelong without a spirituality, without a prayer life, without a community of faith to sustain you. But that commitment to justice is like extraordinary, and we're doing a heck of a job, I think. Like, they're doing a job now the like of which was never done in my time. I had no sense, really. Now, you were taught to be good to your neighbor and help the poor, but there was no sense that, like, the sense of a performative faith that we have now is very deep. Now, I could tell you the difference between the Immaculate Conception and the Virgin Birth. You know what I mean? I knew that I had a verbal literacy in my faith that this generation probably doesn't have. But the performative literacy wasn't nearly as strong.
I don't think we were aware of the need, though.
Yeah.
To go back to when I was a child. And as you said, we looked after our neighbours.
Yeah.
We were kind to them, elderly people, we did little things. But we weren't aware of the big wide world the way we are today.
And the structures, that is not enough to feed the hungry. You have to ask why they're hungry in the first place. And then address those structures and so on. No, that's a huge part. That's a huge positive to build on. But then you could also bring them to the Eucharist as a way of sustaining their commitment to live justly, that they'll need to come to the table, which he did. He brought them all to the table. Other signs of hope? Well, as we go along, let me just whip through a little list. And then we're going to take a break and come back and take this a step further. I think there are embers. There are embers, lots of embers that could be fanned to flame. But I think, and some of you have mentioned some of them already, the generosity to the poor. I think that Ireland is still some second or third in the world in giving to the poor, and especially to places of famine. And of course, that's not a coincidence. I mean, it's the memory of the Gerda Mura that drives us to that. But that is a huge aspect. And that's a very rich, a spiritual resource, I believe. And the Irish have a commitment to it, the like of which you don't find in other cultures, because they come out of a different tradition. You don't find anything like this in Korea. I'm not putting down the Korean culture or the Confucian traditions at all. They have other rich traditions, but not toward the poor. The commitment to social justice, which of course is the structural commitment to the compassion. The sense of community, I think, is still very deep, at least in the villages, and that's what do they call it in Gaelic? Spreeshock. Was that the word for the coals? The spreeshock. The love of nature, I think, can be a powerful. You can be close to God. There's a deep nature emphasis in Celtic spirituality. There's a positive outlook on life that I think is rare, and yet it's deeply grounded in faith. In fact, it's primarily grounded in faith. The faith response to death that you've mentioned already. I think the poetry and the storytelling and the ability for conversation and for imagination and so on, I think there can be seeds. Deep seeds of faith. One of my favorite poems, it was the Garden of the Golden Apples, a long garden between a railway and a road, a very ordinary place, in the sow's rooting where the hen scratches, we dipped our fingers in the pockets of God. That sense that indeed in the midst of the poetic and the imaginative and the creative, it's God's spirit that the aesthetic and the ascetic are first cousins. What faith to teach? We'll talk about that. Let's take a 10-minute break, 5-minute break. Take a stretch. Take five. Let's read. What do we say? What did we say, Thomas? 3 minutes? 10 minutes?
Yeah.
10-minute break. But we will keep it to 10 because we've miles to travel. So take a 10-minute break. We'll regather. We're going to talk about what faith. What faith should we be teaching? What's at the heart of the faith, and then how to do it? All right. Let's take a break. 10 minutes at most, and we'll regather. Yeah.